All right, returning to the program as promised, the top of the hour is our resident expert on things Trump, Stephen J. Harper, adjunct professor of law, Northwestern University, and the author of stuff that's, I think at this point, too numerous to mention. So, Stephen Harper, could you just please re-educate our listenership as to what you have put out there regarding Trump? You got on our radar initially, but the work you were doing over at Bill Moyers' site addressing Trump's mishandling of COVID, and you were dead on. And that's when we reached out to you, and well, you've been dead on ever since. But kind of review some of this, what you put out.
Yeah, I guess emphasize the word dead when it comes to COVID, because the way Trump handled it, you know, he killed hundreds of thousands of Americans. That's the way he mishandled the pandemic. But there's that. There's the Ukraine timeline. There's the Trump-Russia timeline. There's the impeachment timeline relating to the January 6th insurrection, and then a series of explanatory articles in between. There was a time for about a year when Bill Moyers archived his site because he was going to retire, and then he came back. So that for a year there, I was on Dan Rather's site rather than Moyers. I republished all of it on my personal website at all, which is thelawyerbubble.com or the belly of the beast. A lot of different ways to find me. Just Google my name, you'll find it all. But the Trump-Russia timeline and the insurrection timeline and the pandemic timeline, you can go to the BillMoyers.com site and you'll find that they're all right there prominently still.
And we hope that all of our listeners will do so. Although I'm proud to note that an awful lot of that stuff that is in print, we have talked about on the show in bits and pieces over the years.
Yes, you've been very generous with your time and giving my efforts some play. It's always amazed me, and when people go back and look at some of the stuff that I've written, I didn't really do anything other than pull together facts. You know, I operate from a premise as a recovering trial lawyer that the best way to persuade people is just, you know, don't tell them what to believe. Just lay out the facts and let them draw their own conclusions. So that's going to be the most persuasive. And when I go back and look at some of these timelines that I put together on all the topics that I just mentioned, it just astonishes me that Trump has managed to skate on all of this stuff.
It's absolutely mind-boggling.
And now the Supreme Court in this idiotic immunity decision has basically given him a blank check to do whatever he wants in a second term. It's discouraging, frankly, as a lawyer looking at this stuff and as a citizen.
Well, we did reach out also to Michael Trachtman, whose excellent book on Supreme Court decisions we talked about many years ago. We reached out to him a couple of years ago to see if he would come back on the show and sort of update what's happened in the meantime. And he declined. He just said he did not want to go there. And he seemed very discouraged about the latest developments.
I wonder why, because, you know, it's really up to people who understand the magnitude of these problems to speak up, because, you know, everyday ordinary citizens, you know, they're busy with their lives. They don't have time to try to figure out what any of this stuff means or how bad is it or how good is it or, you know, what are the implications of what they're doing. And it's really up to those of us that have a better sense and some context or legal training to look at this and say, look, you know, this is a 5-alarm fire. You know, this is a real problem. This is not a drill. This is the real deal. And when people say, you know, a threat to, you know, that's the problem. You know, people say, oh, he's a threat to democracy. And they all go, oh, yeah. They always say the other guy's a threat to democracy. This guy really is a threat to democracy. And what the Supreme Court has done, thanks to him and his ability to have appointed as many members of the court as he has, is created an insulating barrier around him that's going to make him largely unaccountable. Framers of the Constitution, when all is said and done, relied on the good faith of the actors who are going to be, you know, the critical players in the system. And if you don't have that going for you, boy, you're just in a world of hurt. And that's the lesson that we should be learning from Trump's first term and from what he's now promising to do if he's elected to another term.
I want to return to the Supreme Court in a minute, but fresh off the presses, apparently Trump, in talking to someone yesterday, the day before, made a comment about how, well, there might not be another election. He alluded to that somewhere in his discussion.
Oh, yeah, that was his rally in Wisconsin. It was a conference of evangelicals. I'm not sure it was Wisconsin, but it was definitely a conference of evangelicals. And the comment he made is, look, just get out there and vote. Vote in 2024. Just do it this time, and then you'll never have to do it again. Now, there are two ways to play that, right? One is to say, oh, yeah, there he is. There he is. You know, there's proof. You know, no more elections after this one if he wins. The other way to play it is to get inside, you know, the psyche of Trump, which cares only about Trump. And this is my own personal theory, and who knows what's in that in that cobwebby brain of his. But I believe that what he was trying to communicate was, and some people have said, some of his so-called defenders have said, oh, well, he was just joking. Well, the one thing he wasn't doing was joking.
No.
That's a stupid defense. I think Tom Cotton gave that defense, the senator from Arkansas, which is really stupid for a guy that, has the Ivy League education that he has. But my own personal take, and even my wife disagrees with this, she has a more sinister view of the guy. She may be right. I think what he was saying, look, I'm never going to run for president after this time. So if you vote for me and I win, I don't care what you do after that. It doesn't matter to me what happens to the country. I only care that I win. So vote for me, and then I don't care what happens in 2028. And that would be pretty consistent with him, with his personality.
Sure.
And his character or lack of character. Now, the counter to my argument is, well, then why did he pick J.D. Vance? Because that was kind of a statement of his intention to create a legacy with Vance. And a lot of Republicans are asking today, why did he pick J.D. Vance?
Well, I think it sounds like Peter Thiel picked J.D. Vance and convinced Trump it was a good idea.
It was a colossal mistake, for sure. And it's only going to get worse for both of them. And I believe that at some point Trump will turn on him. Whether he'll turn on him enough to actually dump him from the ticket or persuade Vance to leave the ticket, I can't say that he'll do that. But he's going to turn on him. And he's going to turn on him when the polls, which have already started to deteriorate for Trump, as they get worse, he's got to find somebody to blame.
Shades of Thomas Eagleton.
That's it.
Speaking of Thomas Eagleton and George McGovern and Frank Church and I think a few other conservative Democrats, in reading Joe Connison's book, it really struck me the degree to which Paul Weyrich and Richard Viguerie reached out to the Christian fundamentalist preachers during, I guess it was, well, they were reaching out all along, but when they turned on Jimmy Carter, who had the audacity to suggest that the various Christian colleges might want to integrate and their tax status came under question, they all en masse turned against him and jumped onto the Reagan ship. And there was Viguerie and Weyrich and all these people ready to package them up as Republicans. And man, that was astoundingly successful, starting with Ronald Reagan up to the present.
No, that's right. Trump is a manifestation of a far deeper problem that goes back, as you rightly say, decades in the making. And it's not going to go away when Trump goes away. But he's tapped into it in a very big way. And he's done what the prior sort of iterations of that mentality have been on, we're not able or we're not willing to do. He's made it all seem respectable. He's made it okay for people to climb out from underneath their rocks, and wear Nazi insignia and use all kinds of misogynistic and racial epithets. That's all okay to do now.
This goes back to a term you don't hear much lately, which was the new right. This term sort of came bubbled up in the 70s when the Goldwater contingent of the Republican Party was gaining in power and really liking the prospects of Ronald Reagan, and were turning their back on all of the so-called mainstream Republicans like Gerald Ford and Nelson Rockefeller.
They remade the Republican Party into something that is, for many Republicans, unrecognizable.
Yes, and Connison's mentioning that since he's left office, George W. Bush is now just considered, you know, passé, and someone who didn't deliver as he was supposed to. And even though Bush made all this noise about being a born-again evangelical, which, of course, they loved, they managed to do a complete 180 on this and say, well, we've got Trump, and he's none of the above, but he must be anointed by God. And it comes down to, like, this anointed by God thing.
Which, of course, is the definition of a cult.
Pretty much.
Or one of the revealing criteria. You don't have a political party that's really a political party. In that sense, Trump was right. He's always said, you know, people don't understand, this is a movement. Well, you know, Hitler was head of a movement too for a long time. And you know, anyone, I actually wrote about this in a recent article for Common Dreams, which is where some of my stuff now appears fairly regularly. If you want a parallel example in history to what's happening now, take a look at Germany, the Weimar Republic in the 30s. Some of the parallels are absolutely frightening.
Yes, they are.
One of Hitler's big coups was persuading, you know, German, you know, wealth and industrialists that he would be the one who would protect their wealth. And the enemy at that point was communism. They were all scared to death of communism. But now they're scared to death of regulation and higher taxes. And that's the thing. Now it's all out in the open. So they're saying the quiet part out loud. Trump is over and over again. You know, he holds these fundraisers with the oil executives saying, you guys come up with enough money and I'll make sure that we get rid of all of the regulations that relate to restricting profits on oil and climate change and all that stuff. Out the window it goes.
Well, we mentioned this at the Supreme Court a moment ago, and I guess Joe Biden is echoing what a lot of people are pointing out, that Supreme Court, there's some flexibility in how the Supreme Court can be constructed. It has had more members and fewer members over the years, and it has always traditionally been something that was an appointment for life. A lot of people looking around and thinking that, well, that might be something we need to change.
Yeah, here's the problem. He's got basically three things that he wants, that he's proposed, right? Two of them require, I believe, and so do most constitutional scholars. Two of them would require a constitutional amendment. Now, just to put that in perspective, to have a constitutional amendment, you need two-thirds of both houses of Congress, and then ratification by three-fourths of the states. It's not going to happen. But that's the only way that you can, for example, do anything about the immunity ruling that the Supreme Court has adopted. That was one of Biden's proposals. A second proposal similarly requires a constitutional amendment, I think, and that is trying to limit lifetime tenure of judges to 18 years. There's a theoretical way you could do that, but the Constitution specifically says that Supreme Court appointments, like all federal judicial appointments, the person who gets such an appointment gets to hold their office through as long as they are on good behavior is the standard, which means they got to be impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate. That's how you get rid of a judge. Now, there is a theoretical way that you could say, well, what if we adopted a statute that just said for the new judges that are appointed, they're appointed to an office, a different kind of office that's not a lifetime appointment? We understand we can't retroactively take a current federal judge and make him an 18-year judge instead of a lifetime appointment, but by statute we could lock the new guys in to 18 years. Well, that doesn't really help you with the current court at all.
No.
So there's that one. And then the third thing is a code of ethics, you know, an enforceable code of ethics. No one has yet explained to me or anyone else how you would enforce it. Now, having said all that, you might ask me appropriately, is this a waste of words? Is this, you know, is Biden just pandering to the left? Is it all just a sort of rhetorical ploy? To which I say, even though these things would be difficult if not impossible, to accomplish either legislatively or through a constitutional amendment, there is value in bringing them to the surface. Let's at least talk about them. Let's at least start the conversation about them.
Yeah.
Because 80% of Americans want term limits. 80%. 37% of Americans disapprove of the current Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is in really big institutional trouble. Trump has managed to destroy that institution as well with his appointments. So I believe there's actually value in putting the issue on the table so that people have to look at it, think about it, and can't just ignore it. Because, you know, sometimes it can take a decade, you know, maybe it never happens. But it's sort of like if you think back to FDR and his packing the court plan, he proposed adding Supreme Court justices because the Supreme Court was unraveling his New Deal.
Right.
Once he proposed it, although they never voted on the legislation, you know, within 2 months, the Supreme Court started, oh, gee whiz, I guess we can uphold the National Labor Relations Act. Oh, I guess we can uphold the Social Security Act.
Uh-huh.
There may be an interim effect, if you will, in having it out there. Now, having said that, are guys like Alito and Thomas impervious to any kind of public pressure? I think the answer is yes. I don't think they care what anybody thinks about anything. They view themselves as above the law. If somebody wants to give them stuff, they can give them stuff. If even though there are laws that require them to report gifts, they don't. So what? What if I don't? What are you going to do? You know, nah, 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 nah. You know, tell your mother. They're impossible.
It's a sad commentary on where we stand right now. We have less than 100 days. As we speak right now, to the election, we've decided that we probably owe it to the listenership and the nation to try and do what we can to just amplify the ideas that are gaining some traction. And one idea I just, you know, before we go, I want to address is that the fact that Trump is nuts and is talking like a madman seems to be gaining some traction.
Yeah, well, guess what? You know, Trump made the election about old guys with dementia. Well, there's only one person who may fit that bill left in the race. But you're exactly right, and I commend you for continuing to shine a light on this stuff. You know, if not us, who? If not now, when?
Exactly. We're heading now toward Kamala Harris, the troops rallying behind Kamala Harris, who I think is not a perfect candidate. I just read a few hours ago, Steve, that her dad is a Marxist professor at Stanford University. I guess that hasn't gotten out yet, but I think it will.
Sure. Well, they'll do everything they can to frame her in the worst possible light, but it's kind of tough. I mean, you can't go after gender without getting yourself in trouble. You can't go after race without getting yourself in trouble. She's got, I think, a very persuasive theme, which is, you know, I prosecute felons. I know this. I know who I'm dealing with.
Well, and I certainly hope she'll take advantage of the fact that as a woman, she's more germane to the issue on abortion. The Republicans are certainly vulnerable on that. I mean, most people are not happy with overturning Roe v. Wade, and Democrats need to take advantage of that.
Yep. No, I think that's right. And she's willing to speak far more openly and candidly than, you know, about that subject. You know, Biden was even reluctant to use the word whenever he talked about it.
Right.
So I think you have it exactly analyzed correctly.
And let's hope as we move into the future, the next month or two, that this issue of global warming will be revived. I know when Biden and Trump had a debate, they just kind of pussyfooted around it.
Yep. Well, this is the other thing that I'm hopeful when Harris debates Trump. Because
Do you think they will?
Yeah, I do actually. I think he's going to try to figure out a way to slither out of it, but I think it'll be too hard for him. I think both interpersonally, you know, he is going to want to be portrayed as a coward. I think that he'll have to do it. I've watched Harris in many different settings, you know, where she was in, you know, questioning witnesses in her role as a member of a Senate committee, and she knows how to ask a question. And you know, the kind of pass that he got with the first debate with Biden, where no one called Trump on any of his lies. She's not going to let him get away with that, I don't think.
God, I hope so. I hope when Trump says something like killing babies after they're born, she'll just say, whoa, hold on.
Yeah. Where is infanticide allowed in the United States, or actually in the world?
Yeah, where did Roe v. Wade give a green light to that? I mean, come on.
Absolute nonsense. But see, that's the sort of thing now that, you know, with Biden out of the race, I think that Trump runs a real risk of much greater scrutiny of everything he does, including his demeanor. One of my favorite recent things is, you know, when he showed up at the convention with this patch on his ear, giant patch on his ear, right? Well, apparently there's another picture of him playing golf a day or two on either side. I can't remember which. No patch. Nothing. Swing away, you know?
That's our boy.
That's it.
Well, this will be our last show this week in the month of July. It's going to be a very, very interesting August. And let's see what the hell happens in this convention. The whole thing is so bizarre that Biden drops out and says, okay, give it to Kamala. And in spite of the fact we're supposed to be a democracy, we're all going to honor it. But I think that it's important we do so, because we got to circle the wagons and run some credible candidate to stop the impending disaster.
Yeah, and you know you're on the right track when you have Republicans like Mike Johnson complaining that the Democrats are somehow acting in an anti-democratic way that they want to challenge. I mean, talk about projection.
Yeah, and they were going to challenge it legally without being able to explain what the hell they were going to challenge.
It's an argument that is completely without any legal basis at all. The lawyer that files that lawsuit is going to be at best sanctioned and at worst disbarred. There's not even a good faith argument to be made.
Stephen Harper, it is always a pleasure, sir. Let's speak again in a couple weeks.
You got it. Have a good one, Doug.
All right.
Thank you.
Maybe we want to put a plug in for thelawyerbubble.com, where you will find, I guess, all of Stephen Harper's writings. And it's quite an assembly of, I would say, clear thinking literature. Well worth checking out. Well, it turns out we have about 8 minutes left on the program. And I guess what I'll do at this point is something we do like to do from time to time, which was go to the obituaries. We've often used the quote, I forget who it's from, some British politician saying that the news consists of informing people that Lord Jones is dead. People who never knew Lord Jones was alive. I'm paraphrasing. But I do hold in my hand here an obituary that caught my eye as I was returning from Croatia in June. It was in The Economist and chronicled the passing of the artist June Mendoza, whom I admit I knew nothing about. But her life story has some interesting moments. That's why I'm talking about it. Noted The Economist that she was Britain's most prolific portrait painter. She died last May at the age of 99. Magazine notes that her career as Britain's most called-on portrait painter was to encompass most of the grandees of the land. The list began with royals. 3 Prince Philips, 2 Annes, 3 Charleses, 2 Dianas, 5 Queens. She got very good at painting pearls. After these came archbishops, generals, prime ministers, eminent musicians, famous sports personalities, captains of industry, and entertainers. But mixed in with these, described as her pickups, perhaps a third of her output, were people she just spotted in restaurants around the street and decided to do their portrait. The magazine noted that all were surprised, but almost all went along. It's noted that her gift for catching likenesses was nothing she had learned. It was something you were born with, like perfect pitch. They note her professional sessions often had to be done at breakneck speed, especially with the royals. I don't know whether she's saying so busy. They might last merely an hour scattered over several weeks. On the first meeting, she would set the rules because no matter how grand her subjects, she was the boss. Even in Buckingham Palace, she was free to choose the chairs, the background, and the clothes, unless a uniform was required. They note that at the start, most sat carefully, but it was in the breaks when they dropped the pose that she could think, that's it, and then pounce with her brush. They note that portraiture was not just about faces. Body language was also more important. She wanted to observe straight away the shape people made as they stood or sat, the tilt of their shoulders, how they held their heads. That gave her a frame for the rest. After shape came color, almost always oils for richness. She hated working from photographs, which she thought of as a gauze between her and her subject. She wanted their energy and she wanted the paint to show it. Around 17 colors made up her palette. One was flesh tone, used only as a base. When this baffled people, she asked them to look at the palms of their hands. They seemed pink, but she also saw Naples yellow, olive green, oranges, and mauves. The magazine notes she was never completely happy with any of her paintings. There was always a flaw. She was painfully aware that a beautiful painting could be a poor likeness and vice versa. A good likeness had to catch alertness, dynamism, life in short, and please the sitter. A good painting, in color and composition and technique, had to satisfy and even move viewers who had no idea who the sitter was. This is a world I know nothing about, but I am fascinated by it and how someone can sit down with a paintbrush and capture somebody on an easel. And lastly, we note the passing of Lou Dobbs, who for some reason I had a favorable impression of until I read his obituary. The cable news host gained prominence during CNN's Moneyline during the 90s. That was during their dot-com boom. Then began spreading conspiracy theories in the 2000s on Lou Dobbs Tonight. He was a strong proponent of the birther theory, falsely claiming that Barack Obama wasn't born in the U.S. After his show moved to Fox Business Network in 2011, Dobbs morphed into one of Donald Trump's staunchest supporters and an informal advisor. He rebranded himself as a populist, using his folksy demeanor to give voice to economic anxiety and often scapegoating immigrants. When Trump lost re-election in 2020, Dobbs amplified claims of election fraud, and that proved his downfall, to which I say, good! I guess the voting machine company Smartmax sued Fox for defamation, naming Dobbs as a defendant, and the network then canceled his show. Dobbs never admitted fault. We still don't know what happened, he said in 2022. For his part, Dobbs scorned the idea of journalistic neutrality, saying his shows told people what mainstream publications didn't want them to know. I hope that every time the government lies, he said in 2006, our broadcast grabs them by the scruff of their neck. Well, I have to end by saying I approve of that sentiment. Mentioned in his obit is the fact that at one point, he took a break from what he was doing and started up the astronomy news site space.com. Which I confess to looking at on a fairly frequent basis. It's not a bad website. So I guess Lou Dobbs wasn't all bad. That pretty much does it for today's program, which was produced by Edward McMillan. You've been listening to Radio Parallax. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. Our thanks yet again to Stephen Harper for his excellent insights. We'll look forward to getting more of those. We expect to be with you for most of the programs between now and Election Day. Maybe not all of them, but I think most of them. I think this is a time for people to stand up for democracy, or at least what's left of it.